I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday the 15th of October, and as we record this in the late evening, the number of COVID-19 cases around the world stands at over 38.7 million. That's a rise of over 2 million on last week. Around 40,000 more people have died with COVID in that time, with the total now exceeding 1.09 million. In Ireland, total deaths now stand at 1,838. That's an increase of 21 on last week. That's double the rate of last week's increase, while cases in that time have risen by about 5,000 and now stands at over 45,000. That case increase is up about 42% on last week. Now, later in this episode, China. Life has largely returned to normal there, but are its COVID solutions a realistic fit for a liberal democracy like Ireland? We'll have an in-depth look with our reporter Yvonne Murray. But first, three counties have gone to level four, 23 counties are in level three plus. Here's the Taoiseach announcing the measures last night.
For that reason, the government has agreed this evening to move counties Donegal, Monaghan and Cavan to level four of the framework. As people will know from the document that has been sent to every home in the country, there are a number of key changes between level three and level four. These include, but are not limited to, people should not have any visitors to their homes. The maximum number of attendees at a wedding is six. Gyms, pools and leisure centres will close. There will be further restrictions on hotels, guest houses and B&Bs. Non-essential retail will close. Everyone except essential workers must work from home. Construction and manufacturing will continue with proper protections in place. This will be difficult news for many people and many businesses. But the budget we announced yesterday has given us a number of new measures to help these businesses, and I will talk about them shortly. But first, I want to talk about the rest of the country. As I said at the start of these remarks, the new Level 3 status has been with us for 1 week. We are studying the infection patterns very closely in order to understand what effect Level 3 is having, and we want to continue to do that for the next week. As I have said before, full implementation of Level 3 can have a significant impact on the spread of the disease, but only if everyone follows the rules, and in particular, follows the spirit of the rules. And the truth is, there are concerns regarding the full implementation of Level 3. These concerns include poor application or adherence to measures in the areas of home visiting, sports training and events, people going into the workplace when they could and should work remotely, as well as slippage in areas such as retail and personal services. And so the government have decided that we must introduce additional restrictions within Level 3 on a national basis. And these include, but are not limited to, no visitors will be allowed to homes.
Now, we'll return to that later in this episode with news reporter Sharon Tobin for a bit of an explanation. But first, let's get some detail on today's briefings and numbers with science correspondent George Lee.
Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, George, how are you?
Good, very good, Colm.
So over the last, you've been looking at the numbers for quite some time, but over the recent weeks, they've got more and more disturbing as far as trends go. So can we look at intensive care unit beds, first of all, George? That's a particularly concerning statistic, I suppose. 29 people with COVID are in intensive care beds. It doesn't sound like much, but hospitals are open for general business, so the pressure on beds is higher.
And the intensive care beds is a real issue, of course. And as you say, it's in around 29, 30 people in the last couple of days. But the big thing here is, I think, the new forecast, or the new projection in terms of where we're at. And this would have come from Professor Philip Nolan this evening on the basis of the new more deteriorated picture that they're picking up and have told us about this evening. They're saying that by the 31st of October, if nothing changes and the trajectory that we're on, we will have between 80 to 110 people in intensive care. That's within 2 weeks. So they're extremely worried. They're not forecasting that because obviously people can change that by their behaviours. But that is a huge increase. If you say we're in around 30 today.
But they're not forecasting that. But the rate of hospitalisation has actually exceeded what they modelled for to date, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And this is an exceeding. This is what they're saying the implications of that is going to be. So they have said, even their forecasts, they're saying their trajectories, they're using different words. So they're not saying this is inevitable on any of them, even on the hospitalizations, but they're saying this is the model, this is the way we're going. Can people change their behavior? If you don't, you get to this level. That's the difference between the forecast and the trajectory. But ultimately, the issue is, has behavior changed? And it certainly does look, on the basis of some of the things we heard about this evening from Neffert, it doesn't look as if behaviors have changed significantly. So they're really worried that we're looking at a very significant increase in hospitalizations and in intensive care. What they're talking about, you might remember, that about a week ago, we were hearing projections that we might be heading towards of the order of cases of 1,100 to maybe 1,500 cases by the 7th of November.
That's been revised upwards now, hasn't it?
Now they're saying 1,800 to 2,500 cases, not by the 7th of November, by the 31st of October. And they're also saying because of that, they're looking at a very worrying situation for the hospitals. We heard from Paul Reid in the HSE today that there is a lot of anxiety in the hospitals right now about what's going on and what November will bring for them. There are particular pressures, and he focused on and he highlighted three hospitals where there are real serious concerns at the moment, and they would be Cavan, Letterkenny and Cork University Hospitals, where the people who are managing those are particularly worried about the trajectories that they are looking at. So very serious concerns. And there was nothing about this evening's presentation from Neffert that was in any way that would in any way make you feel that things have just improved. Everything is about a significant deterioration in the situation. And in fact, that's what the chief medical officer said in his statement, rapidly deteriorating disease trajectory nationally.
Yeah, well, as I was saying there at the outset of this episode, the number of deaths up until in the week prior to last week's episode was 11. The number of deaths in the week prior to this episode that we're recording now was 21. That's doubling. Now, that's a very crude statistic because things vary over the week, but it has gone in that direction progressively over the last while.
Yes, and I suppose, I know deaths are very difficult to pin down because sometimes you find after the fact that they're assigned to different dates. Like there was one point a couple of weeks ago when we heard of 10 deaths in one day, but none of them had occurred in that month. So I'm kind of reluctant to kind of get too dragged into when the deaths occur. It's more so the trajectory of the disease because there is an inevitability about it. One of the big issues is obviously when you mention deaths, one of the big concerns is elderly age groups. And there has been a significant disimprovement on that front. The figures today are showing that for the 14-day incidence for people over the age of 65, that has increased in the space of a week from, say, about 93 to 125. But within that, the incidence for people over the age of 85 has actually tripled. So it's really very concerning. And they're the ones and the age group where people are particularly concerned about the potential for the mortality associated with this disease.
And we've seen already one of the warnings about the rate of spread in the community was it's not entirely easy or it's nigh on impossible to protect vulnerable people in settings like care homes. We've seen fatalities in care homes from COVID and clusters in care homes in a way we hadn't seen for quite some time.
That's right. And when you look at those older age groups, the trajectory of the likes of that over 85, you wonder where they are. Is there more going on in nursing homes at the moment than we actually know at this point? Because that has gone from 25 cases per 100,000 to 77 in the space of a week. So maybe I don't know what's going on there, but they are the very elderly age group and one wonders.
There are cold crumbs of comfort here, George. I mean, one thinks back to the 1980s when Garrett Fitzgerald was talking about graphs to do with unemployment. He was trying to be mildly encouraging by saying that unemployment was still increasing, but it was increasing by a slower rate. The Dublin statistics are something similar. The rate has slowed of increase in Dublin.
Not tonight, I'm afraid it's changed.
All right, well, tell us about Dublin.
Well, the new information is that, yes, we would have had the situation in Dublin where you would have had the level three restrictions did have an effect in terms of slowing down the pace and the increase in the incidence rate of the disease. So it leveled off at around 170 to 175 cases per 100,000 people in the Dublin area. But I'm afraid that the numbers now is that there has been a renewed growth of some sort in the Dublin numbers. There were 288 cases today, I think it was, confirmed today. And they're now saying that the increases in Dublin, which they've seen in the last couple of days, are a major concern. So these things are changing so quickly. This disease is out there and spreading very, very quickly. The rate of increase, the reproduction has accelerated. We're in and around still around the one-ish reproduction rate in Dublin, but they're very worried that they're beginning to see those increased cases right. in Dublin. And they're making a specific point that there is a major concern now about those Dublin numbers, and that's only in the last day or two.
Right, it's 1.8 for the rest of the country, isn't it? So I think it may explain why people want people not to travel to work, because a lot of people work in Dublin and they don't want people presumably coming from other parts of the country where things are worse up to Dublin.
Well, I think in terms of people travelling to work, I think that their point is that they're looking at these numbers which they presented this evening. The numbers come from Google Mobility data, where they're tracking people's phones, and they're looking, and also transit data, and they're looking at where people are. And in terms of where people are, they're finding that there hasn't been any fall off in the number of people in workplaces. And they're very concerned about that, because they're wondering why people are going to work when the situation is the way it is. And the HSE made this point too, from Paul Reid, a very, very special appeal to employers to seriously consider who in your employment has to be in the workplace. And the, Ronan Glynn, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer this evening, making the point that they are still getting huge a number of reports about people ringing their doctor with symptoms of COVID-19 from the workplace. Why are they going into work with symptoms? This is what's driving them nuts. So again, if they can get people to stop unnecessary travel, whether it's for work or otherwise, whether it's to Dublin or wherever it is, that's what they want to do. And the recommendations at the moment are you stay within your county anyway. So they're very concerned. They're, right. There's nothing about what they said this evening which is, shows anything in terms of significant changes in people's behaviour yet, or in terms of getting on top of this disease. If anything is running away from us, the increase in the incidence over the past week, the number of cases is now 82% higher than it was in the previous 7 days. And they're very worried. They're now chasing something that they wanted to get ahead of.
Okay. Is there anything, George, even a modicum of optimism to be gleaned from schools?
No, there's, well, you know, the cases in schools, obviously, they're maintaining that, yes, there has been a number of cases, obviously, and tests and so on done in schools, but that, and that broadly that is stable. The modicum of positivity might be in terms of the age groups. You find that the numbers, the incidents in the 0 to 4 and the 5 to 12 age groups are still relatively low, but they have both increased over the last couple of weeks as well. So schools, they're still saying, aren't a major source of spreading it. That's the modicum of positivity, but apart from that, this is not a good day in terms of the story of this disease.
Okay, thanks, George. All the best.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
And now to China, where, as far as we know, it all began. The country, at least according to official data, has very low case numbers in the low double figures. Deaths remain below 5,000. Mass testing of millions of people has been restarted in recent days after the discovery of small clusters, which we'll hear more of in a moment. Reporting for RTE from China, Yvonne Murray spoke to me earlier. So Yvonne, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. So where are you at the moment?
I'm in Beijing at the moment.
Okay, so the latest news in China is they're going to test an entire city. Why and how many people?
Yeah, well, this is the city of Qingdao on the east coast. And it seems that there was an outbreak there and 12 people tested positive. It seems that it originated with some people arriving in from overseas, and they were taken to the hospital in Qingdao, and it spread from there. But only 12 cases, but it just shows you how China reacts to these outbreaks now. It has tested several million people in the past few days and says that it will continue to test until the whole city has been tested for COVID-19, not taking any chances. And it just shows you as well that the capacity they have for testing whole cities. They did this before in Wuhan, before the lockdown was lifted there in April. They did it in Xinjiang when the outbreak happened there. So this is something that China has shown great capability for.
And how is this testing done? Do they get people into testing centres? Is it setting up checkpoints? Is it going to people's homes?
Yeah, I think it's all of those things. I think one interesting thing about the way that everything is organised here, especially residential communities, is that things like this, testing points can be set up very quickly, literally on the side of the road. So they will bring teams down and set up tents, and you can go in, you can drop in and get yourself tested. And they will also send notifications out to all the residences for everybody to come forward at particular times. So it's quite well organized in that respect. There's also no choice in the matter. So if you get the government edict that you have to be tested, then everybody knows that there's no escape from that. Basically, you have to go and organize the test. But it is convenient in a way because you can go into any testing center and they're very nearby and there's plenty of them.
And so the data that's been produced by this mass testing, it's turning up obviously quite detailed data, and they can respond on a very localized level to even the smallest of outbreaks then.
Yeah, that's right. And what's interesting about this latest round of testing is that they haven't really found anybody else who's been infected, apart from those 12 cases. The interesting news today is that the head of the chest hospital in Qingdao was removed from his post because he was being blamed for this outbreak and not following protocols. There was some suggestion that medical equipment hadn't been sufficiently cleaned, and that allowed the spread of COVID-19 there. The head of the commission as well, the health commission in Qingdao, has been suspended from his post during investigation. So this shows you that the authorities, when they do react to an outbreak like this, that people's jobs are also on the line. So something that's taken very seriously.
And in this kind of zero tolerance environment, what are the overt signs of COVID precautions on the street? Is there still mass wearing, or has it reached a point whereby they've been so successful in tackling the virus that life has returned to almost pre-COVID levels?
If we spoke last week, I would have said, yes, everything is completely back to normal. And it was. I mean, the masks had gone. You know, the checkpoints coming in out and out of residential compounds have pretty much been removed. But as soon as this news came from Qingdao this week, they're back up and running. So, you know, people have their masks back on. Yesterday, I made the mistake of going out to the supermarket without my mobile phone, which meant that when I arrived at the entrance, they wanted to see my health code, which is what you have on your WeChat and everybody has to have it. But I said, well, I don't have my mobile phone with me, and they wouldn't let me in. So I think, you know, a week ago that I would have been allowed to go in and do my shopping and it wouldn't have been an issue because people have sort of become relaxed. But now this week, those regulations have become stricter again. So I think that people can relax for a short amount of time, but as soon as there's an outbreak, people suddenly become very vigilant again.
So just explain the mobile phone health code. You have health data stored on your phone, is it? Or it's stored centrally, and this can be read by anybody in a commercial premises to see what your state of health is, your official state of health. Is that it?
That's it. And I think this is something that, you know, I think is very different about China, because nobody asks questions about this. It is just expected that you will carry around that data with you at all times. And if you don't, like happened to me yesterday, you won't be allowed into places. So this is your health information. And as long as you have effectively a clean bill of health, then you will have the date and the time and a picture of your passport, which pops up on your mobile phone, and it reads no abnormal conditions. So you carry that around and you show it wherever you need to go into. That's only one app. There's also a second app, which is the so-called green code. And that logs everywhere you've been within the previous 2 weeks. So when you're asked to show that, and you're asked to show that when you're trying to get on a plane or on a train, you can actually see on your mobile phone every single place that you've been within the previous 2 weeks. And it tracks it by you putting your mobile phone number in. And then I guess it's just reading the data off all of the data receiving masts everywhere around the country that your mobile phone pings off when you move around. And that data is there for anybody to see. And you have to show it. It's not like there's a choice. You won't be allowed on a plane if you don't show these things.
Right. And the apps are compulsory, are they?
Well, I suppose if you want to do anything, effectively they are. Yeah.
Okay. So I think by the latest count, looking at today's figures, there's just over 91,000 cases across the country. And the last daily rise was of 11 in a country of 1.4 billion. On October 7th, the figure was 7. I mean, these are extraordinarily low rises. People might raise an eyebrow at that and say, really?
Yeah, I mean, there's a question, isn't there, about the official data, because we know what happened back in Wuhan at the very beginning of this. If we cast our minds back to January, even December last year, it was covered up. The number of cases was kept under wraps for several weeks, which meant that the reaction was very slow. Still, there is a question for many people as to whether the death toll in Wuhan and across the country, which is just over 4,000, can really be accurate given what we have seen in other countries. Nevertheless, they are the official figures. The only thing I would say now about whether we can trust the data is that in some ways, I think a lot of local officials have learnt their lesson about the consequences of covering things up. So I think perhaps there's an incentive in some ways to be more forthcoming with the data. Having said that, there's also an atmosphere of fear here. The fear that if something happens on your watch, then you could lose your job, as we've seen with the officials in Qingdao. So we have those two forces kind of working against each other. I think at the moment, I think most people are kind of trusting the official data. And we can only hope now, as we're heading into the winter, that it is accurate.
Certainly the outward appearances anyway would indicate that at least there is less cause for concern in China. The network of Fankang hospitals that were set up, the quick build hospitals, are largely closed down. And by August, we saw a massive pool party being held in Wuhan. So if there is concern behind the scenes, they're doing a very good job of hiding it.
Yeah, and I think there's also now a sense that this is a real source of national pride. The fact that China really has, to all intents and purposes, vanquished this virus while other countries are still struggling with it. For many people here, that feels like a real vindication of their political system and the way that it has been very forceful in controlling it. Some might say they have a kind of authoritarian advantage in that they can force people to comply in a way that other countries can't. For example, there were examples of people during the lockdown in Xinjiang, where there was an outbreak in the summer, in July, where people were actually handcuffed to the railings on their compound because they tried to leave. There were other incidences of people actually being welded into their apartments by people on the outside because they feared that they had COVID-19. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that you wouldn't see in other societies. There's also another factor at play here in China, and that is that people are terrified of getting sick. There are many people here who work in very insecure jobs. So if you don't work, you don't get paid. And I think for many people, the risk of getting sick and not having any income is just too much. So people are much more inclined to comply with regulations because they're terrified of getting ill.
And there is a different political or individual philosophy at play in China. The idea of the greater good holds a far higher importance maybe than it does elsewhere in the world.
You know, I think that's an interesting question. People say that, but in my experience, this is one of the most individualistic places I've ever lived.
Right.
And I think that people look out for themselves. I think there's a kind of survivalist element to Chinese society because life has been very tough traditionally. I think people's loyalty more often is to themselves and to their families. There is a sense that you're looking out for yourself in a very tough environment. The sense of it being a kind of a collective sort of communist approach to society, I'm just not sure that it's true in how people, in their outlook and in how they behave. I hope that doesn't sound too harsh.
No. But
I suppose it's just a personal observation.
Yeah, and on the national pride front, in following on your recent reporting trip to Xinjiang to report on the situation with the Uyghurs, which if we were dealing with an interesting subject in another podcast, we could get in depth on that. But I went down to the Chinese embassy to interview the ambassador, as you know, and they were very keen to give me literature on how there are two freshly minted books on how China beat the coronavirus, handed out to me as a parting gift, I suppose you might say. So yeah, obviously, not only is their national pride being felt, but they're keen to advertise it as well.
They are keen to advertise it. And if you look at the press here, the state media, the kind of government mouthpieces are very much full of how China has done a much better job on COVID than anybody else. There is a huge amount of news about how the US in particular is struggling, the number of deaths there, the fact that people are protesting against mask wearing, the fact that the president himself came down with COVID-19. I mean, these are all moments where, you know, Chinese state media is having a bit of a field day and being able to show that its own society doesn't suffer from any of those things.
Right.
So, yeah, and that they're also watching the US election very closely here to see, you know, what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah, aren't we all? The other interesting thing, it seems to be, is that for, by and large, a virus that seems to have had its origins, at least of this outbreak, in China. Within China, it seems to be seen now as a foreign phenomenon, and that including how they apply restrictions, including the most recent ones in Beijing, where you are.
Yeah, that's right. So for a long time, the borders were closed, and actually, I left the country in January, just as the outbreak was happening here, and I came back just before they closed the borders here. And I have to say, very lucky to get back at that stage, because subsequently people were not allowed back in, even if you had a valid visa. So for months, people have been kept out of the country. And I mean, kind of, you know, expats working in China weren't allowed back in. And they have just recently relaxed those laws. So people were allowed to come back in as of last week, fly back into Beijing. But they feared that imported cases were the only source of the infection now. So they have capped the number of people who can arrive in the city to 500 a day. And, you know, this is a huge reduction compared to, you know, the usual inflow of people into Beijing. But for China, you know, Beijing is obviously the capital. They do not want another outbreak here. They want to keep it safe, and they want to make sure that it can continue to function. So, yeah, they are going to keep people out as much as possible. And I would say that anybody who is arriving into the country now, they still have to undergo the 14-day centralized quarantine. So it's not like you can come and quarantine in your own home. You have to go into a government facility, a hotel, which you have to pay for yourself. And you have to pass, I think it is now, 3 COVID tests before you're allowed out.
Right. Okay. That's pretty rigorous. All right. They also seem to have this innovation for the mass testing. People might wonder, well, how do you test a city of 9 or 11 million people? But they have a rather clever plan of batch testing, where they don't look for the results of the individual tests initially. They look for the presence of COVID from a batch of tests of maybe 5 to 10 people.
That's correct, yes. And I think the interesting thing about the mass testing, there were some concerns at the beginning that they weren't picking up enough of the positive cases. One health professional told me that it's only 30% accurate. So there was a fear that they were missing a lot. That fear doesn't seem to have been borne out, because now, as we've seen with the recent outbreaks that we mentioned, you know, the one in Beijing, the one in Urumqi earlier on, they did mass testing in both of those places, and they were able to keep a handle on the outbreak and relax the restrictions fairly quickly. So the hope is that that will happen again with this Qingdao outbreak.
And finally then, just in terms of, to have a look at your own experience of it, so you came back in January, and you did quarantine. Did you quarantine in one of the state facilities, or at that stage could you go back to your own home, and what was that experience?
Yeah,
like?
We came back on St. Patrick's Day, actually, and we were lucky because it was pretty much, as far as I remember, the day before they changed the restrictions. So I think the following, we arrived on Saturday, and I think on the following Monday, they stopped people coming back and being able to quarantine in their own home. So you had to go into a hotel quarantine after that. So yes, we quarantined at home. And at the time I felt it was actually quite difficult because you're stuck inside with children. You know, for 2 weeks, we couldn't even open our windows. People would have to deliver food to our doorstep. We weren't even allowed to open our front door. I called the management office for our building. And I said, well, I need to pick up the food off the doorstep. And he said, if you open your own front door, I'm going to have to call the police. And he was trying to be nice about it, to say, you know, these are just the restrictions. We all have to adhere to them. But it's a very weird feeling when you're inside your own house. You can see your food on the doorstep. You're not allowed to open your front door.
Reach out the letterbox with a fork in your hand. Or how did you ultimately manage that?
Well, I had to call the management office and they had to come round in a hazmat suit. And he would take the sticker off our front door, which indicated that we were in quarantine. He would remove that, then he would open our front door and he would put the food inside and then he would close it himself and seal it again with the sticker. Right. So that's how we lived for a couple of weeks.
Not a time to experience plumbing difficulties or for that matter, to lose access to whatever your children like to watch on television.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, in retrospect, we were fortunate to be able to quarantine at home, considering some of the other experiences that my friends have had in centralized quarantine in one room, you know, with two or three tiny kids. One of my friends recently told me they were literally climbing the walls. So, yeah, not very easy for people who've had that experience.
Right. And how's your homeschooling skills?
Dire, I think. I have not shown any signs of improvement on my homeschooling in all the time that I've done. But that's another thing to mention. You know, the school started back here in September, having been closed since January. So it's a very long time. They didn't open again before the summer. The schools just went back in September. So everybody now is keeping their fingers crossed that they'll be able to stay open and that China can avoid another outbreak when the cold winter months hit.
And restaurants, bars, grocery shops, communal mixing, all of that kind of thing. I mean, is there social distancing again, or is this a situation whereby
No, it's gone. I mean, yes, there was. When we first arrived back, if you went into a restaurant, there were only a couple of people allowed at each table and they had all the tables very far apart. That has all been gone now for several months, I would say. A complete sense of normality back in Beijing. Everywhere is open. Restaurants are open. Shops are open. People are not social distancing at all. So if you get on public transport, you know, you have to be prepared to be crammed in with everybody. I think people are still wearing masks for the most part, but even then, much more relaxed, people wearing them on their chin now. But definitely not social distancing in the way that perhaps people are having to adhere to in other countries.
Okay, look, thanks a million, Yvonne. Look after yourself.
Okay, thank you very much.
And finally, for this episode, let's return to the restrictions and our reporter Sharon Tobin, who's been working on an explainer of these measures. She spoke to me earlier. How are you?
I'm good.
Will we tell the listeners about the setup?
Yes.
How far away are we? Am I 10 yards away from you, maybe?
You are possibly, I'm not sure where you are. We're in different rooms anyway.
We're in different rooms in the same building.
These days.
We're level 4 material here, which I suppose requires an explanation, doesn't it?
It does require an explanation because there are some parts of level 3 in level 4 and then there's also the level 3 that have a few bits added on as well.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, let's.
So will we start at the start?
Let's start at the start. What counties are in level 4, first of all?
Okay. So it was announced that Cavan, Donegal and Monaghan are going into level 4 from midnight. So that will mean that until November 10th, those three counties, which are all border counties, will have extra restrictions. So more than the other 23 counties in the Republic.
So what kind of restrictions are we talking about?
Right. So what it means is that things like non-essential retailers. Now, this is slightly different to what we had with the original lockdown back March, April. Non-essential retailers now, under that, hardwares can open. But things like hairdressers, beauticians, certain clothes shops can't open. So they need to be deemed essential whether it's for office or for if they sell electrical goods, things like that.
Okay.
Now, that's just one part of it. So public transport in Cavan, Donegal, Monaghan, that's also going to be reduced to just 25% of its capacity. So only one in four bus seats, are going to be available. Gyms, swimming pools had been open up until this. They have to close now. You had been able to book in, but that's now a thing of the past. They're going to close altogether. Libraries too are going to close, and libraries had kind of upped their online offering. So they're now telling people you can still get stuff from us, but you just have to do it online. You can't just pop in or make a booking to pop in and get them. Now, weddings, this is a big one as well, because so many people have had their wedding dates changed and reorganized, rescheduled. From Monday, it doesn't affect this weekend. They seem to always allow people the weekend to get these restrictions and to reorganize everything for themselves, especially when it comes to weddings. But from Monday, only six people can attend the wedding. So that's bride, groom,
bridesmaids,
whoever's going to officiate at the wedding, bridesmaids. Yeah, so six people. It's really small. It's going to be a tough one for lots of people. Funerals, they're leaving the same though. 25 people. It's still only 25, but yeah, staying the same. This one is interesting now, because pubs and restaurants in the three counties that are going into level four can operate. Now, it's only outdoors and it's only with a maximum of 15 customers. But when you think about it, that's interesting, because in Dublin, which is still on level three, wet pubs are still closed.
So is it wet pubs can still open in the three counties and outdoors?
Well, outside Dublin, all pubs are allowed to open. Okay. So outside the capital, you have in all the other counties, pubs are allowed to open. So that's going to remain in place for the three counties that are now on level four, but they'll operate with those rules that it can only be outdoors and it can only be a maximum of 15 customers.
And obviously I was driving up the N7 today, there was Garda enforcement, there's signs up for checkpoints, there was a big tailback, I think, around the Black Church, going from the Black Church into traffic that was moving from Dublin towards Kildare. What kind of enforcement, or do we know at this stage, is going to be in place in the border counties? Because people crossing from Northern Ireland into the Republic has always been a tricky issue. Do we
have any
clarity on that?
It's always a tricky one to police. No, not really, because, you know, I think they're loath to stick checkpoints on those kind of routes as well. And there are different rules in place in Northern Ireland. The rules for Northern Ireland, they're being even referred to differently. It's called a circuit breaker there, and those rules are in place for 4 weeks as well. Slightly different, they come into effect from tomorrow, but their pubs and restaurants are being dealt with differently, so they have to close except for takeaway. And also, no alcohol can be sold in like supermarkets or off licenses from 8 p.m. Now, other things, hairdressers, beauticians, they're going to close as well in Northern Ireland. Churches will remain open, but you have to wear a face covering. And of course, the schools there are going to close. So that's a big difference between Northern Ireland and even the border counties, where we've got level four restrictions coming in. The schools there are going to close for 2 weeks over the half term.
Is that it for kind of level four as far as the enhanced
that's
restrictions
That's it for level
go?
Four,
so,
yeah.
Okay, let's look at the rest of the country then. Level three, what is it? I mean, we kind of know what it's generally meant. It's the situation that's pertained before, but it's house visits really, isn't it? That
yeah, it's level three plus, if we're allowed to call it that. It's level three with some extra restrictions. Now, in the COVID plan, living with COVID, you know, it does allow for extra additions to be made in certain situations. And I suppose this is one of those situations where they're going to allow for an extra restriction to be added in while you're still in level three. So what we're going to see is household visits banned, and that's indoors and in gardens. So in those situations, that's in all 26 counties in the Republic. So somebody will only be able to visit a house or a garden if it's to care for somebody. So that will cover, you know, a multitude of caring, including childcare, I guess. But that's a big difference for level three, you know, and that's also in place until November 10th.
And sporting fixtures under level three.
And sporting fixtures, they had an exemption for things like club championships. And that's now gone. That exemption is gone. And it will also mean that training can't go ahead unless it's done in a socially distant way. So there's some of the things in level three that had exemptions and now they don't anymore.
And no changes to retail in level three, I suppose.
Retail remains the same. They're the two big ones. It's really the exemptions for sport that's been taken away, and they're trying to reduce the number of contacts that people have within level three by banning household visits. But you can still, under level three, so while you can't have anybody over to your house, you can still go out and meet six people or be in a group of six people from two different households once it's not in your house or in your garden. And I suppose that's to facilitate things like exercise or perhaps outdoor dining in the places that are allowed to have outdoor dining.
All right. It'll be interesting to see what the traffic is going to be like going from north to south in border areas at about 8:05 in areas where there are off licenses close to the southern part of the border.
Yeah, I feel there'll be traffic. How much they'll be stopping people, we'll just have to wait and see.
All right. Thanks a million, Sharon. All the best.
All right.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back next week with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongine@rte.ie. That's colm.omongine@rte.ie. Or you can contact me on Twitter @colmomongine. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. Thanks for listening.